Hi, this is The Enquirers. That's a Cincinnati podcast, but not today. Today, we're talking about Southern Ohio, and particularly Pike County, where eight people were killed about a decade ago. I'm Northern Kentucky reporter Jolene Almendadas, and I'm very interested in true crime, but I don't have anything to do with the reporting of the Pike County murders case. So I'm also here with two people who have done just a ton of work and reporting to tell this story fairly and accurately. So I'm going to hand it over to you ladies so you can introduce yourselves.
I'm Patricia Gallagher Newberry, and I've been with the Enquirer second time around since February of 2022, and I covered a significant development in this case in the fall of 2022.
Liz Dufour, I'm a photographer, and I just retired in September after 42 years, 35 with the Enquirer. I was here in the very beginning of Pike County. It's been 10 years. It's crazy.
All right. And so thank you both for being here. So a little bit about me is that I have been purposely avoiding finding out more about this case, specifically because when I found out about it, I knew that you folks had done so much reporting and I wanted to hear about it straight from you two. So I'm going to start with Patty and say, just go ahead and set the scene for everybody when the police show up, set the scene for when this crime happens.
Well, I was not there, Jolene, so I'm going to turn it over to Liz here in a second. But just in general, if someone is new to this case, there were eight people killed in Pike County, Ohio, on the night of April 21, 2016, and the morning of April 22, 2016. There were four different crime scenes, and the victims were shot at close range. Most of them in their beds, not all. Two were awake and on their feet, but shot at close range in their beds in the dark of night. And it was a total mystery at the very beginning about why they were killed, what the motive was, and just, you know, a lot of alarm about the whole case. So, Liz, you were there from the very beginning. Why don't you kind of jump in?
Yeah, when we first started hearing that, first off, Pike County is about 2 hours from here. It is not in our coverage area. So first word was that there was two people killed, and we're like, well, we won't go on that. I mean, you know, you're thinking that it's a, you know, husband, wife. I mean, who knows what it is, but it's too far away. But then as the day progressed, it was like, now there's four, and now they're, you know, it kept on growing. And finally we said, we got to go. So we went that first day. You couldn't get very far. But one thing I will say about Pike County is, and I spent a lot of time driving, it's April, it's springtime, it's gorgeous. And I remember driving, it's very rural, and I remember driving the back roads to get there in a sea of yellow flowers, just a sea of green and yellow flowers and big trees, and everything is green. And you're realizing this isn't Cincinnati. This is a whole nother area. The next day or the day after that, we flew it because that was the only way you could get anywhere close to it. The road where three of the houses are, everything was blocked off. So we did a lot of standing around with the cop cars and the, you know, barricades, just wondering what had happened. I mean, it was kind of a, you know, unfathomable that eight people were killed in four different locations.
Well, and at this point, when you say flew it, you did a drone or?
No, we didn't have drones then. We had a helicopter. Oh. So one of our photographers, Pat Reddy, flew in a helicopter to get the overview of Chris Senior's and his son Frankie.
Wow.
Frankie.
Right. So at the beginning, Liz, what was the interaction with the media? Were there regular press conferences, or was it just kind of dribbling out as journalists could find somebody to talk to?
Yeah, there was press conference regularly, which we covered. I mean, we were pretty much, once we knew what had just happened, we were pretty much there every day, all the time, weekends. And there was a lot of, you know, DeWine was attorney general at the time. He was doing regular press conferences, but
Ohio Governor Mike DeWine.
Yes, the governor. Yeah, he was then attorney general. And they just didn't know anything. I mean, it was kind of, I mean, you, I don't think anybody could really wrap their head around the fact that it wasn't just like one house and eight people died in one house. It was like four different scenes over a course of late one night into the next early morning.
Well, and that's so as a reporter, when I have been to scenes and we have national coverage and like, CNN, ABC, NPR, like everyone is at the scene. It's shocking to me. So can you let people know what it is like when there is one of these huge national events and it kind of takes over a town?
It does. Yeah. There was, it was a national story. I mean, because it was so incredible. And so, yeah, there was a lot of media roaming around and there wasn't really a lot for the media to do. Nobody was talking. You couldn't get close to any of the scenes. Even we could go to the street where Kenneth was or the road, but we couldn't even see his trailer. And there was cops there. So we really couldn't get anywhere. That's why the helicopter shots were very important. The press conferences were very important. But I remember photographing a lot of just no trespassing signs. But yeah, there was media crawling all over each other. And, and if somebody ran, you probably would be running after them because they're leaving. Do they know something? So you're going to,
So during this time, all right, so there's like national media, eight people murdered, different like homes. Patty, you told me a little bit about this, that during this time, there ends up being sort of an explosion of rumors because time goes on. And like y'all were saying, people don't know anything and there are no arrests for a while. So Patty, can you fill us in on that part?
Apparently, some of the victims were involved in growing marijuana. And so early on, there was a rumor or a theory that was discussed, even mentioned by then Attorney General DeWine at a press conference, that drugs were a motivation here and that perhaps it was a cartel kill. And then the counter narrative to that was, well, if it was the drug cartel, they would kill everything in sight, right? But in this case, at the four different murder scenes, children were not harmed. There were three children found in the four different locations, and pets were left alive. And so, again, the counter narrative was, wouldn't the cartel kill the kids and the pets too?
Wait, children, how old were these children? Like, what?
Yeah, there were three children in two different spots. So two of the children, one was 6 years old.
Yeah, they ranged from 4 days to 3 years old.
Four days old.
Yeah, yeah. There was a newborn at one site with
Hannah
one
Roden,
of the victims.
Hannah Roden had just had a baby 4 days before.
So the children were left unharmed. They were sleeping in the very places. Yeah, one child was...
Two. The
one was on a couch...
Right.
In Frankie's, and one was between Frankie and his fiance, Hannah.
Right. And then Hannah, there's two Hannahs. It gets kind of confusing, but then Hannah Roden with the four-day-old. She was in the bed, baby.
And so I'm just going to interject the timeline here just to say, can you all tell us, we're going to get to a point where we really talk about the people who were killed and take some time to say about them and tell a little bit about some of the things their families have said about them. But for now, can you tell us who are the people who were killed in this situation?
Right. So there were eight family members, or more precisely, seven related people, and then one who was a fiance to one of them. It's the Roden family. So we got Chris and Gary at, we'll just call it crime scene number one. Crime scene number two, right next door in a trailer home is his son, Frankie Roden, and Frankie's fiance, Hannah Gilley. A bit up the road, same street, Union Hill Road, was his ex-wife. Her name was Dana Roden. They had been divorced since about 2007, I believe. But they were amicable. They were, And Dana Roden, and she lived there with, and she had just moved into this new location. They'd kind of swapped trailers. She was there with her daughter, Hannah, and her son, Chris Jr., and Hannah's baby, four-day-old, Kylie. So that was the third scene. And the fourth scene was Kenneth Roden, brother to Chris Roden, And he lived a little further, deeper in a camper, essentially, at his place. So those are the eight people.
And when the 911 call first came in, it was, you know, you can hear the 911 call, and she thought they just got beat up.
Wait, who is this?
The Bobby Joe Manley went to the house to do some. She did some work and watched, you know, fed the animals, and she sees all this blood, and she thinks they've been beaten up, and so she calls 911, and then she runs to Frankie's trailer to say, "Oh my God, your dad's been, you know, you're beat up," and then she finds them
right next door. Yeah,
right next door, and so that started, you know, everything going.
Okay, so this horrible crime happens. It's a media circus. There are some, you know, press conferences. And this is just the most wild part to me. Then what happens after this? What happens after the crime?
It takes a while to investigate. So investigators have, you know, said on the record that they suspected the people who come to be arrested early on, about 4 months after the crime. But that it takes them a very long time to piece together the evidence to put the case up against them. So it's 2.5 years before there's an arrest. And that's a very long time for speculation to swirl and the family to get, you know, more and more impatient and citizens of Ohio wondering what the heck is going on. Why isn't this case moving forward? So, yeah, 2.5 years for an arrest.
And to go back to the 911 call, because it's interesting how why the number trickled out. So she runs the next door and finds them dead. And then another family member turns up and she's like, "Oh my God, we got to go tell Dana."
Then this someone, is the former wife of
right.
victim number
so
one.
So then they
and
go
the,
to
the
Dana,
mother of victim number two.
And they find three more dead. Mm. And so now the police are at, on one road, Union Hill, they're at the, you know, three different locations. And then it's not till hours later that someone says, "I want to go tell Kenneth because Kenneth needs to know." And then they discover him. So it was family members that discovered everybody. I mean, because, you know, it wasn't like the police would have said, "Oh, if this is dead, then we need to make sure that," I mean, you would have not, you know, they thought it was, you know, contained. I mean, who would know? But family members kept on discovering as they went to alert them at what had happened. They find them dead.
So 2.5 years until an arrest. And during this time, it's just rumors. Like, does the public know anything going on? Do the families know?
I don't think the families know. I know some of our reporting at that time was there were some family members who were interviewed, who were willing to talk. And they were just waiting for law enforcement to do its part. And it was a long wait.
Well, you know, in the Wagners and Rodens were connected from the very beginning because the Hannah Roden was had a daughter, Sophia, with Jake Wagner.
Well, so that gets to the next part. So there's an arrest. Who is arrested? This
yes,
is where I feel like
this
the case
is two,
gets
two
even
and a half,
more mind-blowing.
Right. 2.5 years after this crime, on the same day, within hours of each other, four members of the Wagner family are arrested. So you have Billy Wagner, who's the father, Angela Wagner, who's his wife, and their two sons, George Wagner and Jake Wagner. And then later, two grandmas get charged. But did they get arrested on the same day? They might have.
I can't remember.
They might have. There were, let's see, Billy was arrested while in Lexington delivering some horses to a vet or visiting a vet there. Angela was arrested at the home she was living in at the time, which was Webster, Ohio. And the sons, George and Jake, were driving. They were commercial truck drivers, and they were driving or they were in their truck when they were apprehended. So it all was very coordinated. It all went down at the same time. And all four family members were charged with the exact same 22 charges, 8 charges of aggravated homicide, and then 14 related charges. One son, the younger son, was also charged with a sexual crime for having impregnated an underage person because the woman he had the child with, who became a victim. We're kind of getting ahead of ourselves, but so he had an additional charge related to the relationship with one of the victims.
And okay, so this arrest happens. Put me there, because I imagine that this is just a, like 2.5 years, no word, and suddenly four arrests. What do we learn when these folks are arrested? Like how do they know everyone who was killed? Like, what's the connection here? Yeah.
Yeah, as Liz indicated earlier, the connection is a grandchild that the families had in common. So the younger son had a relationship with Hannah Roden. It was his girlfriend on and off. It was a troubled relationship, we would come to find out later. And they produced a child named Sophia. And Sophia, at the time of the murders,
she was two and a half.
Yeah, she was two and a half years old around the time that the Roden family was killed. So this is the connection between the two. And the Wagner family lived in, I guess nearby, their Peterson Road house would be also Pike County or Adams County.
It's Adams County.
Yeah, the counties are very close together, and all the properties seem to be along a county line. But nonetheless, the Wagner family lived nearby, and there was a relationship, we would come to find out later, between the two fathers of the family.
So they knew each other.
They knew each other, yeah.
But what do we learn? Like what happened? Why did this happen?
they had a lot. I mean, once the evidence started coming out, you know, Billy had done an interview with the FBI. I mean, they had been, before the arrest, they had been talking to them. And Billy sat in the car with two FBI agents. And for a long time, it was all played in court. And he called Chris his best friend. Yeah, he said they were best friends. But yeah, they all knew each other. They were all connected. And I think what the day of the arrest, when it kind of came out that it was a custody battle, that's kind of when you're like, you killed eight people, you know, over, you know, a custody battle. Angela felt like Sophia was being abused. That was kind of at the heart of it.
Right. She felt strongly. So just to kind of put some glue here, journalists didn't really find out. The world really didn't find out about the motivations and the actions of the actors in this story until the trial of the first individual. So during this whole time, we get the charges against the Wagner family 2.5 years later. Another 2.5 years later, the younger son decides to flip for the state of Ohio, meaning he takes a plea and he admits his role in the case. Yeah,
and this is
5 years in, Jake.
On the fifth anniversary.
On the fifth anniversary, he goes into court for a scheduled hearing. And instead of there being a hearing, he takes a plea. He announces to the world that he is responsible for 5 of the 8 killings of the Roden family.
And
so that
Jake
was like, whew, yeah.
Jake is the one who had the child with Hannah.
Correct.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
He admitted that he killed the mother of his child.
So,
And he turned, and during that plea, you know, the Rodens were in court, and he turned to them and said, I'm very sorry. I mean, looked at them.
But that was about it.
Yeah.
Right.
And okay, so he goes, he says he killed 5 of the 8. What else do we learn? Because I think, as we know, all right, so now we're in court. We are understanding the motive. Do we hear from the victims' families at this point, or what's going on?
I don't know that there would have been victim impact statements at that time. Of course, it's shocking, but it does bring some measure of resolution, you know, somewhat. About 4 months later, Angela Wagner takes a plea also, right? So initially all four submit pleas of innocence, right?
They're
going to be not guilty, right? So it's 5 years in, Jake admits his role. About 4 months later, Angela Wagner goes into court and she admits her role, which is not as, the actual pulling the trigger on anyone, but basically helping, abetting, right? So she was aware of the crimes. She helped purchase certain things that were, needed for the crimes. She helped cover up the crimes, Yeah.
And I think that one of the Jake's reasoning for taking the plea, he had found religion and they were all up for the death penalty. And he wanted to take, if he pled, he wanted to take the death penalty off the table and he would testify against the rest of the family. So that was kind of the agreement.
Was the agreement, right?
Is taking the death penalty off.
For himself, for his mother, and for any future cases that would be tried. So that, we've got all that going on, and then nothing for a long time.
Right.
And then really the story becomes more easy to understand at the trial of George, the older son. George did not take a plea. George went to trial, still, saying he's not guilty. And he had a 13-week trial with those 22 charges, and we learned a whole lot.
Wait, were you at that trial?
Yes, that's what I covered.
Because by this time, is it 2022?
It's fall of 2022.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so tell me what you learned. And for people who are just unaware, I used to be a courts reporter. When there's an actual trial for something, that's really when you begin to see evidence. That's when you have exhibits. That's when you have witnesses. That's when you have police showing up saying what they found, how they found it. When there's a plea, that doesn't happen.
Right.
You don't really get that information.
Exactly.
So now we are 5 years in.
We're seven years in.
And we're finally getting this trial. Patty, what did you learn? And then obviously, Liz, chime in here anytime.
Well, yeah. I think we should, the trial was happening in Waverly, which is not too far from where everything happened. But I mean, it was probably, 20 minutes from their houses. But it's a very, very small area. The courtroom is very old. It's one courtroom. The interesting thing is they set up a room for the media because there was a lot of media covering it. And then they had right next to the media room, they had the family, the Rodens. And then we had the jury. So there was some times where you were almost intermingling, which they really tried not to, but there was sometimes I realized, okay, I'm in the bathroom with so-and-so, and I were like, I probably shouldn't be, but you're like stuck.
Yeah.
It was just very confined. There were times they had to tell the media to be quiet because we would start, riffing back and forth on what was going on, and then you realize they're overhearing it.
Courtroom drama. But, what did we learn? Well, for me, I learned everything because, Jolene, I was new to the case. I had joined the Enquirer, a few months before. Sometime that summer, I was aware that the case was coming to trial, and I kind of innocently asked, who's covering this? I'd like to help. I could help, right? And all of a sudden, I'm on a meeting, and it's like, oh, and Patty's going to be going over to Pike County. It's like, oh, okay, yes. And with who? No one, just me and Liz. So, how do you learn about a case? You dive into the docket. You just have to learn everything you can from the previous coverage of your own news organization and from the legal filings. So I spent a tremendous amount of time just trying to get it up to speed. I mean, I didn't even know the victim names and the particulars from 2016. I'd read the coverage, as a longtime subscriber, but I really had to get up to speed. And I remember just running on adrenaline because that very first day that we were all there, or maybe it was a little bit beyond the first day, I remember that the court said the media could go on the jury view, meaning the media could trail along with the jury, which had already been selected, and we could see what they were going to see on the ground, which was the crime scenes.
They took you to the crime scenes?
Yeah, we got to, in our own cars, we had to follow along, and we could stay, we had to stay back from the jury and the lawyers. Even the judge and his court reporter went on the jury. And I was just wild. I mean, it was like, okay, we have to go. We can't screw this up. Let's go.
This is so O.J. Simpson. Frame of reference I have.
And I had a crazy photographer with me that day, Liz. I was in somebody else's car, and I swear to God, he drove 80 miles an hour through these country roads, stop and start and stop and start. And he was just like, a cartoon character of a photographer. But yes, so that was the beginning, right? And what did we learn? Everything about the case. Very, very comprehensive prosecution. The prosecutor seemed to be trying the whole family at once, even though two had already taken a plea. Like, she wanted to lay out everything, every waking moment from the time it happened until the time that the Wagners were arrested and beyond, and just threw out so much evidence. Yeah. So much.
Well, so something interesting about this, and I know I don't want to keep people in suspense. I do want to talk about, like, the biggest things you've learned while you were sitting there. But if you've never been sitting in a courtroom for a case, no matter what the case is, it can start to, I can't imagine 13 weeks. It can drag, because it starts to be like, and where did the street turn? And how wide was the street? And when you get to the door, how many steps are there? And it's so, like, it drags so long. So I can't imagine sitting 13 weeks doing every moment of every day. That's a wild, I'm not a lawyer, but for me, I'm like, that's a wild legal strategy, because juries can only really pay attention for a certain amount of time. But I'm rambling now. But go ahead. Tell me some of the things you learned.
Some of the testimony was of that ilk, you know, having to sit through people reciting their credentials, for example. It's like, come on. But, you know, there was a lot at stake. And a couple of things that are kind of interesting about the trial. First of all, I'd never covered a murder trial. So this was like, whoo. And we could not use any electronics in the courtroom. So I took copious notes by hand on my my pads. And because you just didn't know if something was going to end up being important or not. Some media did sit in the media room and listen to the live feed. Most every day was on live feed. And they took notes there, and then, you know, and live tweeted and so forth. I felt it was important to be in the courtroom, to see people's faces, to kind of have that human interaction. And I do think it won me a little bit of goodwill with some of the family members. They saw that I was diligent and that I cared enough to be there. I don't know. That's maybe I'm just imagining that.
Well, one of the things that we were hamstrung on is after the initial opening statements, which the prosecutor, Angela Canepa, basically laid out the case. And I photographed all the image that she put up. But it was after that that they decided that, because there was a lot of gruesome stuff. I mean, they showed us all the autopsy photos, and there was blood. They decided that we could not photograph anything with blood. So even if there was blood, and every time they would turn to me and say, you know, no, they, even if there was blood on the ground, no bodies, just blood on the ground, they were saying we couldn't photograph it. Thankfully, I had already photographed most of this stuff, because it was, I mean, of course, we would not, as the inquirer, we would have never shown autopsy photos.
Of course.
But to show the scene where they were dragged, and you're just seeing the blood.
Wait, they were dragged?
Yeah.
Maybe we should talk about the actual...
You guys are... Driving me crazy with this one. What happened? Like, what did you learn?
Okay. So let's go over each crime scene, and you can talk about the images as we go along. So at the first crime scene, and this is, again, according to testimony in the fall of 2022 and according to legal documents that we have read and reported on. So this is not us. And yes, this is not us speculating. At the first crime scene, Billy Wagner arrived with his two sons in a pickup truck. The two sons got out of the truck and laid on the ground with weapons. Billy Wagner got out of his truck, out of the truck, and went up to the door. This is Chris Roden's home.
His best friend,
and went up to the door, and then they walked over to an adjacent building where there was a grow room, a marijuana grow room. The whole pretense of Billy coming at 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night was they were allegedly talking about a weed deal. They were going to buy, sell, transport, not sure. So they walk over to the grow room, and they come back. And with that, Billy pretends that he left his phone in his car and he needs to walk back to the car. And that was all so he could tell the sons to go ahead and shoot Chris Roden.
Okay.
Jump in.
Okay.
Did I get something wrong?
Yes.
Okay.
Sorry. So this is from Jake's testimony. With the truck that they had made a false bottom. So Jake and Billy were underneath this kind of
Jake
false.
Jake and George.
George were underneath this false bottom. So if anybody saw the truck, they wouldn't even see that they were back there. Then when they got to Chris's, Billy lets them out. The plan was, and then these guys are going, George and Jake go under the truck. The plan was is that George would shoot. So when Billy brought Chris and Chris around to the front and nothing happened because George froze, according to Jake, then he's like, oh, you know, oh God, I don't have my phone. Can you call my phone? And then he goes back to the truck to basically say, you know, what the hell? And so then Jake takes the gun and then Jake shoots. Shot goes wide. He shoots a couple more times. He's really not sure how many times he shot, but he hit
Chris Roden.
He hit Chris Roden. And then Billy went up there, presumably, according to Jake, and then he shot both of them at close range.
Wait, Chris and who?
His cousin, Gary.
Okay. Gary. So Gary's around for this as well.
Yeah, right, they're both right, there. Right. They're both in the okay. in, they're both in the
entry. Front of the, yeah, in the yeah, front
they're
of the
both
house,
in the entryway.
Kind of on the porch, entryway, yeah.
So then they fall, and again, according to Jake, Billy kind of freaks out. And Jake says, you know, it's too late. You know, we've already done it.
Right.
And so Jake went and took the keys of Chris's and went to the next, you know, barn or whatever to take any electronics out. And when he came back, there was all these blood drag marks. And for whatever reason, and this was never clear to me as to why, but George and Billy dragged the two bodies into the bedroom and covered them up with a blanket. Why didn't they just leave them? But
more
one of the things,
maybe.
And so
it's a guess. So,
so, yeah. So then after that, they say, okay, we got to go next door and get, you know, the next one. So they go there and they see that they're still up. So they get in the car, they take Chris's car. They leave the car that they've started with. They take Chris's, they go by Dana's and they're, okay, they see that, keep going, go all the way to Kenneth's, then turn back around and come back and park back at Chris's. Mm-hmm. Then by this time, Frankie and Hannah are asleep and they crawl through the side door. They go around, Brentley is sleeping on the couch and they go into the bedroom.
And that's the little boy.
Yeah.
The child.
He's the 3-year-old. He's the one that opened the door for Bobby Joe.
Correct.
And then he goes in and he shoots them. Doesn't touch the dogs or their child.
Oh wait, I got lost. Who shoots them?
Jake.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. And
so let's just pause here because there's a lot of new names here. Scene number one: Chris Roden is the victim.
Mm-hmm.
Gary Roden, his cousin, who is there part time, is the victim. They are shot initially. Sorry, Jake Wagner shoots Chris from outside, gets him in the arm, then Billy goes in and, according to testimony, finishes them off, okay?
Oh.
And then other things transpire, the driving around, the waiting for the other people to go to sleep, and now they're at crime scene number two.
Right next door.
Right. Frankie is the son of Chris, and he's there with his fiance and their child. And another child that Frankie had from a different relationship. So that's those two adults and those two children in crime scene number two. And again, Jake has admitted that he was the one who shot both of them in their beds as they slept with their infant child between them and the older child on a couch just outside.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
And Jake has said that him and Frankie were best friends too.
No.
So not only is Billy best friends with Chris, but Jake is best friends with Frankie, and basically they all kind of grew up together. I mean, these are not like families that didn't know each other. They had been in each other's back pocket for many, many years.
Right. Been to each other's homes, socialized with each other, camped.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
So then they leave that scene and they go to Dana's where she is.
Wait, is this next door or is this further up?
This is a little further down the road.
Okay.
And remember that Dana is the ex-wife of the first victim. They're friendly. They have three children together. And so Dana is at crime scene number three.
Yes. And so they go in, the three of them, Billy, Jake, and George, they go in. Jake peers into Dana's room, and Dana's on her phone, like scrolling. And she looks at him, and she's startled, and he shoots her. Then he comes around the corner to where Hannah is, and she kind of gasps. Because the baby, I think, was startled, and she kind of gasps, and he shoots her.
And this is a different Hannah.
Yes.
Okay. This is Hannah Rodin that he had a child with.
Oh, okay. I mixed that up. Okay.
Okay. And then he goes back to Dana. I mean, these are like rooms are next to each other. And then he goes back to Dana and shoots her again to make sure she's dead. Then he goes back to Hannah. Hannah has fallen, and I think he shot her again, too. But she fell off the bed. She was nursing her baby, four-day-old baby. She had fallen off the bed. And he said in court, I picked her up and put her back on the bed because he didn't want to interrupt the nursing. He didn't want the baby to starve. And he goes, I know this sounds weird, but this is what he did.
And this is his child's mother.
Yes. So, yeah.
The infant with Hannah at that moment has a different father.
Yeah.
But Hannah and Jake share a child, Sophie, who's 2.5 years old, and home with grandma. So Sophie is not at any of the crime scenes.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm just blown away because like he had a relationship with this person and he
absolutely a long relationship. A long and tumultuous relationship.
Yeah.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. All right. So this was the second crime scene.
So then they get back in the car and they got a lot of work to do. They go back down the street to Kenneth's. By this time they have both trucks. George parks about a mile down the road. Jake and Billy are together. Billy goes to Kenneth and shoots him once, dead. He's the only one who only had one shot.
And this is according to Jake. Jake says that his dad went in there.
Correct.
He saw
the motivation. The motivation for killing Kenneth was that Kenneth would come in the morning and take a shower at Chris's house, correct? Because he didn't have a shower. He would shower at Chris's before he went to work. And so they thought, oh, no, Kenneth is going to discover that Chris has been shot to death. And so they eliminated him as well.
But they were going to find the bodies. They were going to find these people anyway.
Well, according to Jake, that because he said this is Billy's plan, he said if we don't kill all of them, they're going to come after us. They're going to figure it out. So that was the main reasoning is that they would know it was us, so we have to kill them all.
There was also a moment where Angela Wagner, the mother of the family, said in court that on the morning after the crime, she was watching TV. They were watching news coverage, right? And learned how many victims there were. And she said to her husband in a soft voice, "Why so many?" And his answer was, "Because they were there." Yeah, in court. That's testimony from her time on the stand.
Because they were there, they were not there. They were in different homes and different places. Okay, so we're the third place, and then how do they? So they go to the next location.
Yeah, so then they go back to Chris's. They drop off the truck, and then they go to the Peterson home where they lived. And by this time, it's 4:30 a.m. And they George begins, again, according to Jake, they take the guns. You know, they each had a gun. And he starts trying to cut them up. But that's not really working. Then they were going to burn them, and that didn't work. And they tried a couple different things. They finally decided that they would take the guns and bury them in the pond of their grandma's house. And what was always strange
they
to
didn't
me,
do that at that moment. That right. happened a little bit later. Initially, I think they buried them in their own barn, you know, just right, under yeah. soil, but later transported them.
And the crazy thing there. Was they were off-road truckers. They could have disposed of those weapons in 8 different states.
My mind is boggled
but they
by why they
up,
did this.
But they yes. ended up putting them in a box and sinking them in the pond of their grandma's.
In concrete.
In concrete.
Concrete, where they were later discovered.
After when, Jake told them.
Yeah, when Jake took his plea, he's the one who led authorities to all this evidence and kind of, you know, walked them through the whole night and then what happened with the weapons and then what happened next and next and next. So, yeah.
Okay. So the fourth crime scene, they kill this other person and then how do they – is there another crime scene?
No, that's the four.
Oh,
so,
okay, sorry.
So that's so that is April of 2016. And then, as we said, you know, it was 2.5 years
right.
before
okay.
the Wagner family had been arrested. In the meantime, at the with the explanation that they were tired of people asking questions and the media and so forth, they moved to Alaska for a year. They got they just all four of them and the two their two children just up and left and moved to a little town in Alaska, yeah. Kenai, Alaska.
And by this time, well, actually pretty early on, because they happened April 22nd, by June, Jake had gotten custody of Sophia because mom is dead, he's alive, and no one is pointing the finger at him.
Right. He has not been charged with a crime at that point.
He petitions the court, and he gets the child, which is what they wanted all along.
So all of this, just to back up, we end up learning, and please tell me how this played out in court, that it is because Angela, so Jake's mom, says that she thinks the little girl is being abused in whatever capacity.
Right. Molested.
Molested.
Yeah, not just abused, like molested. I mean, the words she used in court were, her little bottom looks red. And so it was Angela Wagner that had become convinced that the child that Jake and Hannah shared, named Sophia, was being molested when in the care of the Roden family. And she was ruminating on this, and she was talking about it, and she planted this idea with her husband. And then the plot began, you
well,
know?
Well, Billy talked to Jake and said, here's, you know, we've got to get, you know, this is what's going on. Jake said, initially, he was against it. Then he said, I'll just kill Hannah and, you know, we'll blame it on somebody else.
And her new boyfriend.
And her new boyfriend.
And make it look like a murder-suicide.
Right.
This is Jake's original idea. But back up, there was also the possibility that Billy floated that they could just rat out Chris's marijuana growing and just get him arrested to get him out of the way. So they're basically trying to figure out what they can do to get control of this child who is, they believe, is being molested.
And calling the police is not an option for
exactly.
these people, evidently.
Calling the police, calling right. social service, you know, having a doctor intervene, having a religious person intervene. None of that seemed acceptable. They were very afraid of authority. They were very anti-authority. There was one point in where one of the boys wanted to be a park warden, something.
Yeah, he said he could. And
dad, Billy was like, no, nobody in my family is going to wear a badge. This is, again, testimony in court. And so, yeah, it when you explain that a family of four allegedly killed a family of eight over a custody battle of a 2.5-year-old, it's just... it kind of boggles the mind, but that's what they got to, that we want control of that child. We want custody of that child. We think that child's being harmed and we don't trust authorities to take care of it. So what can we do? Well, we could get the father of that family out of the way by ratting him out to the police, or we could kill the child's mother and new boyfriend, make it look like a suicide murder case, or they settle on this case that we're just going to have to kill them.
So Jake just, so we find out in George's trial that his brother Jake and his mom and his dad sort of start floating these ideas back and forth, and then they just picked a plan. Is that what we learned?
And then they spent months. They spent months planning it. They had to get figure out the silencers.
The weapons.
They had to get the weapons. They had to get the silencers. I mean, they all had a lot of guns, but they had to Angela bought shoes at Walmart, you know, that weren't their regular shoes.
They needed a truck to get to the scene. So they bought a truck off an uncle. So it was a matter of months before the April 2016 crime that the family began kind of putting together the plan and the pieces and the equipment. They ordered a ton of equipment online, which authorities were later able to track. They used credit cards at, you know, sporting goods stores where they bought weapons, ammunition, silencers. And then, you know,
So they just left this trail of evidence.
They did. They left
a
trail of evidence.
And it took 2.5 years to arrest them?
Well, it was a lot of evidence, though. And I think that the state really wanted an airtight case. They wanted to just throw everything at them. And so it was really a copious amount of sleuthing. And they turned up a lot of evidence.
Yeah.
And, of course, if Jake had not come forward and admitted his role in the crime, they would not have had the weapons, which are the, you know, most definitive evidence.
Yeah. And one of the things that you know, triggered the, you know, let's do it, let's go, was that Hannah and Jake had split up. You know, she had a new boyfriend. She had put on Facebook that I will never, and she knew he wanted Sophia. And she said, you know, I will never give this child to them. They'll have to kill me first.
No.
Yeah.
It was a Facebook message from a different family member. They also use Facebook quite a bit to communicate. That came into play as evidence as well.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So 13 weeks. You sit through, you learn this information. How does this end? What happens?
George is found guilty after about 7 hours of deliberation. On all 22 counts.
He did not kill anyone.
He did not. So we should probably be clearer about that. There was no testimony that George even fired a weapon. As Liz said earlier, at the first scene, his assignment was to make the first shot, and he either froze or the gun froze. It's a little bit unclear, but he did not shoot anyone. And his brother was very clear about that. And yet he... Apparently, the evidence says, the prosecution says that he was aware of the entire crime. He was there physically. He participated in it. His testimony, however, said he was home asleep. He did not know what had happened in his own house. All four of them lived under the same roof. But he maintained that he was ignorant of what was going on under his own roof and had nothing to do with it and was aghast when he found out that his family was charged with
the
crimes.
He took the stand.
Yeah.
Oh, that's rare.
Yeah, it is.
I feel like that's just an opinion. I feel like it's rare for someone. Yeah, most of the time they do not take the stand.
Well, the surprise was, you know, the prosecution rested, and no one knew if George was going to take the stand, and we didn't think he was, and they said, you know, call your, you know, defense, you ready? Yes. You know, call your first witness. And he called George and everyone was like.
Scrambling. Yeah. Right. So again, that was his testimony was that he had nothing to do with it. And he was just shocked that his family was involved. The jury did not buy that. And so he was found guilty on all the counts and he was sentenced really for the rest of his life. He was sent to an Ohio prison. He's not in Ohio anymore. For security reasons that are not disclosed. He was moved initially to Rhode Island. I have no idea if he's still in Rhode Island, but he's still in the custody of the Ohio Department of Rehab and Correction, but being incarcerated out of state for security reasons. Mm. Right. So.
Okay. So at the conclusion of this, he's found guilty. This is where we get the victim impact statements, which is when the families get to come up and make a statement about the loss that this has caused them. And I know you said some family has spoken on the record. And Patty, you told me that you reached out to some family members as well. Is that right?
Yeah, I have. I have throughout the whole thing. They are really reluctant to talk. But at the just before the sentencing in George's trial, there were, I believe, 8 to 10 family members who came forward with victim impact statements. And some had, some read them on behalf of others. And it was a very emotional day. It was very fiery. In particular, the mother of the of Frankie Roden's fiance, her name again, Hannah Gilley. Hannah Gilley's mother, very, very angry, very anti-press. She really dislikes the media attention to this. But when she has been in court now twice, she is screaming, calling the Wagner family all kinds of names, devil and evil, and you know, very emotional. And other family members are, you know, range from very weepy to very you know, resolved. Kind of the patriarch of the family at this point is Tony Roden, who often speaks for the family. He's one of the brothers of the family, and his comments at the victim impact part of the whole thing was very poignant, I would say. He mentioned each victim by name, and he ended each one. He said something about them and their kind of their personality, and was kind of, it was very sweet and touching, and what he remembered about them or what he missed about them. And then he ended each one by saying, "A life cut short by selfish acts of other people." And I ended up putting that in a story that we put together. It was just so, I mean, even as I say it again, it's like, whoa. So Tony has spoken at one press conference. Other family members have spoken at two different kind of press conferences or comments outside of the courthouse. But aside from that, have not been able to secure a sit-down kind of interview with any of the Roden families. I hope at some point I can, if they're willing to speak.
And the Rodens were at every single, the whole trial, every single hearing over these past 10 years. And photographing them, you know, which was, you know, covering the trial. I mean, I had to, you know, photograph them sometimes, and I knew they didn't like it. And, but, you know, that's your job. I mean, you're having to show that emotion.
Well, and also just the reality of, like the consequence of the action. I hate to make this podcast just all about the journalism, but it does. I've been in your position where it can feel awful to take a photo, but at the end of the day, I sort of feel like the purpose of that is to show the consequence of action and just to capture the reality of the situation. Right. So I won't go on and on about that, but I do want to take this opportunity to talk about the lives that were cut short. So can either one of you tell us a little bit more about these folks? Because I think it's so important that we remember them as well.
So you jump in. Chris Roden. He was instrumental in a facility out in Lucasville called Big Bear Family Resort. He helped build it. He had a lot of cars on his property, so I think he did a lot of buying and selling of cars and car parts. Yes, he had a small marijuana growing operation, apparently, but I think he was someone who took care of a lot of family members. And so, you know, as to how he made a living, those are some of the things we learned about him. Gary Roden apparently had a drug issue, and I'm sorry, I don't know much about him. And he would stay with his cousin cousin Chris from time to time in an effort to stay clean. And I don't know where he worked. So the three kids of Chris Roden and Dana Roden, Frankie Roden was 20. At the time of his death, he was working at a lumber business. He had two children, one with his fiance, Hannah Gilley, and one with a different woman earlier. We've talked about those kids. Hannah Gilley, she was 20 as well. She had graduated from Northwest High School out in that part of the state. And I'm not sure if she was working at the time. If so, she might have been in home health care, as a lot of folks out there were. Dana Roden was an aide at a nursing and rehab center, and she's the mother of the three children. Hannah Roden was a nurse's aide. She's the one who was in the relationship with Jake Wagner and just had had her second child. Chris Roden, 16 years old, was the youngest victim. He was a freshman at Piketon High School. He just got his driver's license. And then Kenneth Roden, the brother to Chris Roden, was actually older than Chris, and he worked at a company, or his employer was called U.S. Utility. It was based in Columbus. He had four children and four grandchildren. And as we said earlier, he was living a little bit farther down the road in a camper, and he would come to his brother Chris's home for showers. And didn't he drive to work with someone?
I can't remember.
Yeah, anyway. So that's what we earlier published about these folks.
And I wanted to add that, you know, we covered all the funerals. There was three different funerals, six together, and then two separate ones. And when I was covering, well, I was there at all of them, but Gary Roden's funeral, which was in Kentucky, you know, you're kind of standing back and you're photographing just people walking. After they got arrested, I went back and looked through every single image, and I had a photo of Billy, George, and Jake walking into the funeral. They apparently attended every funeral.
No.
Yeah. Which was kind of
bizarre.
Yeah.
Right.
I didn't see them in the other, that's the only time I photographed them, but apparently they went to all of them. And I did want to add, so after George was convicted, that meant that Jake and Angela could formally be sentenced because they had never been sentenced. It was always, if you testify, we will sentence you. So after Jake was sentenced, he was standing and he asked the judge if he could, you know, make a statement or something. And he turned around to the family and he basically started preaching to them. And for a long time.
It was a 10-minute statement. And he went on and on about being saved by Jesus and hope that they are saved by Jesus. And it was not an apology. It was basically that you know, Jesus had saved him so he could save other people.
And he's doing good work now. And a couple of the family members got up and walked out during it. Oh. There was a lot of discussion on that the judge should not have let him ramble on so long. It was something that in all my years, I've never seen anything like that. Yeah. I mean, it was...
He spoke longer than the victim, the family members who gave victim impact statements. But he was given the floor, and the family members had a limited clock, right? Like the judge set that they could only speak X, and Jake spoke longer than they did.
He basically was saying that he's
Jake.
Yeah. He's in this great place, and he's helping people, and he hopes they understand that he's, you know, I mean, it was
strange.
Yeah.
So yeah, for the people who aren't around to like see this in courtrooms, that is so strange. Usually when someone is able to give a statement, they usually give it to the judge, and sometimes they apologize, sometimes they ask for a lenient sentence on behalf of, oh, I have children, or whatever their background is. They'll mention a few things, but I don't think I have ever heard people say more than about two sentences.
And he turned around and faced them, which is also unusual.
Yeah, because usually you have to speak to the judge.
He turned around and faced them.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, quite a day. Yeah.
Okay. So is that the most recent? All right. So now I want to get to Billy, because the next thing we know is it's 10 years later, or it's 10 years since the crime, and Billy, the dad, still has not gone to trial, not taken a plea. Tell me everything we got to know since George's trial.
Billy has been in jail for 8 years since he's been arrested. He continues to maintain his innocence, and he has had at least two trial dates that have been pushed. So the case has just been snarled up with appeal after appeal. The latest one deals with the death penalty. The prosecution would like death penalty to be on the table as a possible outcome if Billy is found guilty at trial. and his lawyers don't want that. So there's a fight underway in the Ohio Supreme Court on that. That should be decided within 2 months. And by decided, I mean the court will either take that appeal, like decide to argue that appeal, consider that appeal, or say we're not going to take it. If they don't take it, if the Supreme Court does not take it, then it goes back to the trial court, and the trial court will have to set a date to proceed with the trial. A couple of other things that are in play. The trial might be moved out of Pike County. The judge right now, who's a different judge, we're on the third judge in this case because it's gone on so long. The judge in this case decided that he will move the case out of Pike County because he does not believe that a jury can be seated there that doesn't already have an opinion about the crimes. Mm-hmm. But that the judge has not revealed a new location. So we don't have a date yet, and we don't have a place yet. And we have this Supreme Court battle waging right now. In the meantime, we have Billy still sitting in jail. There has been raised in court the possibility of a settlement or a plea. Billy has said to the judge that he does not want to take a plea. But both sides, both lawyers, do acknowledge that that talk is underway. And the judge keeps kind of putting that on the table, keeps, you know, asking them. So will that happen? No way to know, of course. If not, we'll have a trial that, you know, goes off sometime this year, next year, or wherever. And again, Billy facing the same 22 charges as his son, 8 aggravated murders. And just to review what we already just talked about, in trial, in the earlier trial, his son said, essentially, that Billy pulled the trigger on 3 of the 8 victims. So that would be Chris Roden, Gary Roden, and Kenneth Roden.
So it's interesting to me. I used to do crime courts reporting. Is for a plea to happen like this late in the process. Usually when I think about plea deals, I think of something that happens to avoid the... Plea deals can happen for a lot of reasons. And the way, if you're a defendant, you would take a plea for something like the death penalty to be off the table, kind of the way Jake did.
Right.
But there's also, I guess you can say the system, the court system, the family members of the victims, they also can, quote unquote, benefit from a plea deal because then it's no more court proceedings. They don't have to sit there and look at pictures of their family members. They don't have to hear it. They don't have to do anything else, and it can come to its natural conclusion. So, but there's been so much time and money invested in this case already. It's hard for me to fathom what a plea deal would be, but I am on pins and needles to see if this would actually happen. Because like you said, Jake took the plea deal at the 5-year anniversary of the murders. So I do wonder if we're going to hear from Billy this year.
And a lot of people were mad at his sentencing, what he got, because he was, people thought he should have gotten 8 life sentences, and he ended up getting 32 years.
32 years with a chance of parole after that.
So, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So again, that was just this last January, year ago January, where that was decided. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we have Billy in the balance. And, Liz, I think you have told me that you've chatted with people in the courthouse about Billy's mindset on this.
Yeah. The people who would drive back and forth Billy, they said, he gets, it takes an hour to get to the courthouse. He gets to ride in the van and listen to music. He looks out the window and he's out of jail. And during the day, we serve him. We have to give him meals. He gets fast food. So what's not to like?
Gets to change out of his orange jail uniform into civilian clothes for the day.
Yeah.
So, a break in the monotony.
So Jake's reasoning for taking the plea and admitting guilt was this, religious change.
It was a comedy.
And I don't know that we have that with Billy.
Even though he was a churchgoer, we haven't heard any of that kind of rhetoric at hearings related to Billy.
I did want to add so the judge allowed everybody who took the stand, the witness stand, they could choose to opt in or opt out of being filmed, videotaped. And and a lot of them did. They didn't want it. So we'd have to turn the cameras off. When Jake and Angela took the stand, they were given that same option. So we were not allowed to photograph or record their testimony. I mean, we could, you know, you could take your notes, but the only way we got photos of Angela and Jake was me standing outside the courtroom and being, as they brought them in and then took them back out. Mm-hmm. Those were the only photos we were allowed to get because that was fair game. But everything else, you know, mm-hmm. they could, which we didn't think was fair that, you know, they're already incarcerated, but they were given that same option.
At the sentencing, though, in January of 2025, you were able to get photos of them, as well as one of their mothers who faced a minor crime in relation to the whole thing.
Well, and that was the last thing. So we're waiting for to see what happens with Billy. But you said something about grandmothers? Like, what?
So Angela Wagner's mother, Rita Newcomb, was charged with misdemeanor counts related to creating false custody documents. At some point, they were trying to doctor up some custody documents so that if their parents died, custody would come to the Wagners. I'm forgetting the particulars, but it had to do with custody and Rita Newcomb signing a custody document that was a fake. So that was that. Mm-hmm. Billy Wagner's mom, Frederica Wagner, was also charged with something. Help me, Liz. It was settled pretty quickly, but she was charged with something at the same time that the family, the other four people were.
Basically that they knew about it.
Yeah. Oh, I know what it was. It had to do with taking possession of two bulletproof vests. I don't remember what the charge was, but it had to do with taking delivery of bulletproof vests at her home.
Hmm.
Yeah.
That is.
But those both went away, and now we're down to the final suspect, the final case, and we still don't know when it's gonna wrap up.
This is awful. So we've talked about this. I know you said that you had reached out to some family members, but also people should know that a lot of times, if there's a case still in court, the family is advised not to speak by attorneys. Because say a family member says, I suspected something like this was going to happen, then it becomes like, oh, well, like, what did you know or what did you not know? Or they may say something to hurt the case, whether they know it or not, or to do something that could, like, affect jury members and stuff. So all of these years, like you were saying, Liz, family members have had to go to court, show up to these trials, and wait for some semblance of justice that they're still waiting for. That is continues to be such a mind-boggling thing for me.
And the family's fighting Billy's case to be moved because they're saying it would be too much. It would be burdensome of them to have to travel to another court, another area of Ohio.
Yeah.
I mean, so kind of adding, insult to their injury, that it'd be costly, it'd be time consuming, they'd have to take off work, et cetera. But the judge has ignored those concerns.
Because he says we'll live stream it and you can watch it on live stream.
Yeah. The judge in this case, kind of as a side note, is quite a character. He's gotten a lot of pushback. He gets into verbal tit for tat with the prosecutor and with some other, players in the whole drama. So that's been – and he makes decisions based on his own priorities. Mm-hmm. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah. All right. Well, I feel really caught up in this horrific case. I didn't know a lot of this. And then, Patty, I know when you and I were talking the other day, there were a few things that I said, okay, so just to say, I'm going to transition to this part when we're doing the podcast to ask you about such and such. And then you would let a detail slip, and I'm like, stop telling me. But now I feel like I know all of the ins and outs. And just thank you both so much for, like, giving me some of this. Was there anything else that you all wanted to tell people?
There is a video that you know, you might want to link to, and it basically lays out Jake's testimony and gives a step-by-step of exactly how everything happened with photos.
Liz produced that.
Yeah, right. And it's what they listened to, the video they listened to before they went out.
To get psyched up.
Yeah, to get psyched up. Yeah.
Yeah, Liz did a fantastic job in producing a lot of great assets to tell the story. I would just say that even though we think we know what happened that night, there's going to be another trial. And I'm sure we're going to learn more about the motivation of Billy Wagner and his exact involvement. We'll have a different set of witnesses, and we'll see if Billy Wagner takes the stand in his own defense.
All right. Well, thank you both so much.
Thank
I appreciate you being here, and I appreciate our listeners letting us divert from the typical That's a Cincinnati format to really talk about this case and how it came together. So thank you both so much.
You're welcome.
You're welcome. You.